To BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. This is Wednesday, September 5th, 2012, and this is podcast number 200. We've got about 264, 265 files on BadQuaker.com, but this is the actual 200th podcast. So that's kind of a milestone. I'm a little bit happy about that. I needed to cover a couple things today before I get going. And then I want to do a little bit of a recap of yesterday. And then I'm going to continue talking about on the topic. Well, the title of today's podcast is Voting, the Practical Realities and the Moral Truth, Part 2. So it's a continuation of yesterday's podcast. Yesterday I talked about the practical realities of voting on the national level in the U.S. and the practical realities of voting on small scale in like a town or county or even state levels in the U.S. And so I'm gonna recap that a little bit, and then I'm gonna go into the moral aspects of this. Now, if you want to hear more on this particular topic, and if you'd like to hear the other side of it, so to speak, I'm gonna be recording a debate with Mark Edge from Free Talk Live. Mark is a friend. I like Mark a lot, and I anticipate we will have a very friendly debate that will be informative for all parties, me and Mark and anybody listening. Hopefully we'll be able to allow Mark to fully express his opinions, and hopefully I'll be able to fully express my opinions. And we're going to try our best to make it as entertaining as possible. We're hoping to get that recorded and posted for this coming Monday. That would be Monday the 10th of September. So if you have an interest in this topic of the last 2 days of podcasts, be sure and check out the debate with Mark. I'm sure he'll have it posted at his website, and I'm going to do everything to have it posted at Bad Quaker on Monday. And that should be a really good debate. Now, also, here's something else that's coming up. Friday, well, actually yesterday, I recorded an interview with Becky Akers. Becky, if you're a long time or a frequent visitor to LouRockwell.com, you should be familiar with Becky Akers' work. She's all over the internet, really, but very frequently LouRockwell.com prints her articles over there. And also I wanted to mention, and there's going to be a link in today's show notes as well on badquaker.com, I wanted to mention that Glenn Tate, you know, the author that I had on a couple weeks ago, Glenn Tate, he has two books that just came out 1st of September, and they're available on Amazon, and I'll put links in today's show notes to those two books. The book series is called 299 Days. And it's a very interesting glimpse at a very possible future for the U.S. Be sure and get over to badquaker.com, click that link for Glenn Tate's book, and it's not expensive. You can pick up there's actually two of them available. You can pick them up in several different formats. It's really cheap. And keep in mind, Glenn is a friend. I've known Glenn a long time. I knew him when he very first started this project. He was very enthusiastic about it. I was very thrilled to see early copies of this and watch him work on it. So, you know, Glenn's motivation here is not to become a rich man. If, you know, like he said in the interview that I did with him, if the people he works with ever figured out that he's the author of this, of course, Glenn Tate's not his real name. If they ever found out, his career would be over, and he would lose far more than the little bit that he's going to make off this book series. So just keep that in mind as you're considering whether or not to buy this. This was This book series, 299 Days, was definitely a work of love and passion from Glenn, and not an attempt to make a dollar or two. Although there's nothing wrong with making money, of course. But anyway, consider hitting that link and going over and picking up at least one of Glenn's books and see what you think about it. Now, yesterday, before I really get into a recap of yesterday's podcast, I said something that I expected to be controversial. I was talking about corruption among certain parties in the Ron Paul campaign, and I really kind of thought that would spark people. I expected resistance to that statement. Let's put it that way. But it didn't actually come in that direction. The resistance I got, I should mention this too. I'm way behind on my emails. If you have emailed me and I haven't answered you, hang in there. I'm trying to work through the list. I'll get to you as quick as possible. So you can email me, ben@badquaker.com. I try to read all my emails and I try to answer all my emails. So again, if you've emailed me and you haven't received an answer back, hang in there because I'm trying to get through the stack. So looking at the response, it seems like the thing that I said yesterday that really troubled people the most was not that there was maybe some financial shenanigans going on in the Ron Paul campaign, but it was my statements about Ronald Reagan being shot. That evidently was a little bit more controversial than what I was saying about the Ron Paul campaign. So I want to run through a few facts here, and this stuff is easily, you can find this stuff really easy on the internet without really all that much trouble. My knowledge of this comes to a certain extent from bouncing around on the internet and verifying dates, but also, my family's been heavily involved in the aircraft industry. My dad was a Barnstormer pilot years and years ago. Refused to get a airplane license. He refused to become a licensed pilot. He didn't feel that the government had the right to force him to get a pilot's license. So he flew. He owned airplanes all my life, and he flew all the time when I was a kid. And this inspired my brother. My brother got into the air. My brother was a licensed, still is a licensed pilot. He ended up going into the military with hopes of becoming a military pilot. All different aspects of my family have been, well, I shouldn't say all, there are people who are in my family that are not in the aircraft industry or not pilots or whatever, but a large portion of relatives and people close to my family are either in the aircraft industry itself or directly in the military industrial complex in the aircraft wing. So it's not that surprising that I ended up in the aerospace industry as well. Now, I didn't go directly into the aerospace industry when I left high school. In a manner of speaking, I served my time in the chemical industry in a huge chemical factory, nasty place, where I learned a ton. Though I would not give up that experience for anything. Anyway, I got my experience introduced to engineering. Well, in a sense, I was introduced to engineering by hanging around machine shops with my dad, since I was a little kid, and watching him invent things and stuff. But I got my, job experience with engineering in the chemical industry as a stationary steam engineer, and then utilized that experience and moved in to the aerospace industry, which was where I really always wanted to end up. Well, to a certain extent, I wanted to own a restaurant for a while, and I went into that for a while, and I tried a couple other businesses like that. But there was always this background knowledge that at some point I'm going to be in the aerospace industry, and eventually I was able to pull that off. I got into some pretty good positions, and a lot of that is family related. Most people don't want to admit when, that cronyism exists, but it does, and especially in the aerospace industry, cronyism really is big. And so, yeah, I built up a lot of experience, and I had a lot of talent in the engineering field and with computers when, at a time when it was handy to know those things. And I'm saying computers, I'm saying like, you know, what we were able to do is present PowerPoint presentations in a way that, that bosses with limited understanding of anything could understand it. So I had a talent. When I say computers, I'm talking about simple Windows tricks to convince bosses to support one program or another. So I had that talent, and I had my engineering background and my engineering natural engineering talent, and I was able to get into the aerospace industry. So my point in all that was to let you know that my family has, you know, we've eaten, we've bathed in, we've breathed the aerospace industry since the 60s. So I was raised just, you know, here smelling jet fuel and being at airports and just all around this my whole life. All right, so now I'm going to give you a little bit of history according to Ben. Think about the B-1 bomber for a moment. Now, if you're not sure about what I'm talking about with the different planes that I'm about to talk about, just like with the B-1 bomber, just go to Google Images and just type in the words B-1 bomber. Type that in and see, so you get an idea when you look and you see exactly what, just the shape of the plane, the idea of what I'm talking about when I say the B-1 bomber. So think about the B-1 bomber. Now, the B-1 bomber was designed and rejected in 1961. This is important to remember because if you do Google the B-1 bomber in Google Images, open a separate tab and Google Image YB-49 and take a look at that. Now, the YB-49, you might consider that the grandfather of the B-2 bomber, the so-called stealth bomber, that big batwing-looking thing that's almost magical, that flies without sound. The YB-49 was like the grandfather of the B-2. The YB-49 was maybe, you might consider that 1950 technology, okay? But it got rejected over a series of political nonsense. 1962, the B-1, flip back over to the other tab and take a look at that. The B-1 was rejected. And the reason why it was rejected was because it was too expensive and it was already outdated. In 1962, the B-1 was already outdated. Open another tab, Google Image SR-71. The SR-71 was the creation of 1960s technology. The SR-71 is that beautiful, huge, wow. It's talking about a magical plane. It's one of the first planes I really fell in love with, the SR-71. It's just a magnificent vehicle. Now, that was 1960 technology, the SR-71. Now, flip back over in your tabs and look at the B-1. Do you see the technology gap we're talking about here? Flip back over in the other tab and take a look at the YB-49. All right, now compare these planes. The B-1 should never have been even drawn, much less created. Okay, now, in 62, the B-1 was rejected because it was already outdated. But it was brought back to life by GE and North American Rockwell by Richard Nixon in 1969. As soon as he came into office, he started dumping money down the gullets of GE and North American Rockwell, and the B-1 was rebirthed. Now, at the time, they were looking at each B-1 costing about $40 million, $40 million each. Keep in mind, it is already 10 years outdated by that time. By 1977, that cost was no longer $40 million each. It was now up to $100 million each. And Nixon and Ford after him had just continued to dump money into this program. GE was making money hand over fist in this thing. At the time, in 1977, Northrop, remember that YB-49, that big wing thing? Northrop had already begun work on the plane that would become the stealth bomber, the B-2. So Northrop had a better design in 1977 than this B-1 that GE was behind. But the problem is Northrop has never had the kind of political muscle that GE has had. So Carter came into office, and Carter killed the B-1 project. But then almost immediately he came under pressure, and he quietly unkilled it. He quietly Well, to the public, he killed the B-1 program, but he actually reauthorized 150 of them to go ahead and be built at $100 million each. GE, even though it appeared that GE had lost, GE still won, because GE always wins. In 1978, Northrop caught a little bit of a break, because when Carter, on the appearance of killing the B-1, began funding the B-2. So Northrop had not really enough money to do what they needed to do to build the B-2, but they had some money. They were alive, at least. And Northrop was really struggling, so this was important for them to get this into their pockets. But Carter kept GE alive, and GE was doing fine one way or the other. But Carter kept GE happy by continuing 150 of the old B-1s. And keep in mind, as I'm saying these things, Reagan used to be a spokesman for GE and was in GE's pockets right through the years. Reagan was always tight with GE. When Reagan campaigned for the office of presidency in 1980, one of the things he attacked Jimmy Carter on was his military weakness and the cancellation of the B-1 program. Ronald Reagan made it sound as though the B-1 was absolutely necessary for national defense. Now, the fact was that it was already well outdated when it was drawn in 62. So now we're talking 20 years later. The Soviet Union was supposed to be the big threat, but the B-1 was not effective, on a technical level. It was not any kind of a great advancement. It was not going to be that much more effective than the bombers that we already had. And it was well shown by the Pentagon that the bombers we had were far beyond what the Soviet technology had produced a counter for anyway. So there not only was the B-1 horribly outdated, it was literally unnecessary to have it. But Reagan used that as his hammer to beat Jimmy Carter with during the election. And so Reagan gets elected in 1980, comes into office in the first part of 1981, and he's shown the stealth B-2 bomber for the first time. Reagan comes into office all hawkish on putting through this B-1, and then he gets shown the top secret information on the B-2 stealth. And all of a sudden, Reagan drags his feet. Coming into office, in the first 2 months in office, Ronald Reagan put through one of the biggest tax cuts in American history. In addition to that, he cut over 200 major government programs. He cut the funding for over 200 major government programs. All this in the first 2 months. And he failed to reenact, to revitalize the B-1 program. He let it sit exactly as Carter had it. Now, this really infuriated people like GE. But at the same time, Northrop was very encouraged by this, because they're like, yeah, he's going to continue on our program. Now, as far as I know, Reagan didn't specifically do anything to encourage Northrop, but they were, in that first 2 months, they were super encouraged by the sheer fact that Reagan had not done what he had promised he would in the campaign, which was immediately fund the B-1 bomber. He didn't do that. Instead, 2 whole months went by, and he was in the process of cutting everything, and cutting government, cutting taxes. He was doing all this stuff. And 2 months in, 69 days in office, and Reagan is narrowly misses his opportunity to dance with the devil. Lone crazed gunman puts a bullet an inch away from Reagan's heart. Now, it's hard to talk about the attempted Reagan assassination and not mock the media on this, and not mock the gun haters. Because if you look up information on the assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan, you're going to find the word devastator bullets or devastator ammunition or whatever. And supposedly this is exploding ammunition. And when they opened up Reagan to take out the bullet, supposedly according to the legend, there was this unexploded devastator bullet, these exploding bullets. Oh, well, that's all lies. The Devastator bullet is not an exploding bullet. It is a hollow point with a chemical mechanism inside it that assists it in expanding. It does not explode. It doesn't even it doesn't really fragment. Part of the design is to cause it to mushroom out. Anybody that knows very much about ballistics and knows very much about ammunition knows that what you want in a very deadly bullet is for it to expand, not fly off into many pieces, not explode. There are no exploding bullets in the mainstream markets. That's just silly Hollywood nonsense. So this bullet that hit Reagan was not an exploding bullet, and the medical staff that removed the bullet was not under any kind of danger. The bullet was not going to explode in the operating room. All that is Hollywood nonsense. And the fact that that Republicans actually pushed that really shows you their level of dishonesty. Okay, so enough of that. I'm going to go ahead and break now for the commercial. When we get back, I'm going to try to get the rest of the way through this Ronald Reagan defense defense of my claims, and we'll get on to the main body of the podcast. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help keep badquaker.com on the internet. Thank you very much. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. Now, what I was talking about last there was the actual assassination attempt on Reagan and the silly lies about the Devastator bullet, exploding bullets. Okay, so the first 2 months Reagan's in office, he signs on one of the biggest tax cuts in American history. He actually cut some military programs, but mostly he left the military alone. But what he did, he failed to sign on to the B-1 program like he had promised he would. And this infuriated GE, and it encouraged Northrop. Northrop actually started hiring. I actually interviewed with Northrop. Oh, let's see, mid-'81, something like that, because Northrop was really gearing up. They thought, okay, you know, we're going to be the ones. And then 2 months into it, Reagan gets shot, almost dies. The lone crazed gunman again, we're always told that we have to believe in the lone crazed gunman. Why would we not? If you don't believe in the lone crazed gunman, you must be a crazy conspiracy theorist, right? Okay, so Reagan almost dies. Now, if you recall, there was this odd moment where Alexander Haig, who was the Secretary of State, and George Herbert Walker Bush sort of wrestled for power for a moment or two there. Well, it's kind of interesting because Haig was kind of represents the whole Pentagon military-industrial complex side of government. Whereas Bush, I like to call him, Papa Bush was a deep CIA man and a big oil man. So you've got these two aspects struggling in D.C., and they're regularly struggling, but they're really just aspects of the same monster. So you've got against Reagan, hating Reagan, angry at Reagan, you have the oil CIA interests of George Bush, who, you know, really wanted to be president, very badly ran against Reagan and was very nasty in the primaries. And you've got Alexander Haig, who is deeply tied to GE, deeply tied into the military-industrial complex and the Pentagon, so much so that when Alexander Haig fell out of favor with the Reagan types, he actually ran for the presidency against Reagan, and he made his announcement to General Electric executives at a GE office, at a GE gathering. So that's the kind of connection Haig had with GE. And keep in mind, too, and again, this is not crazy conspiracy theory. This is actual facts that are easy to look up. Both Haig and George Herbert Walker Bush were CFR members and Bilderberger members. Okay, so that doesn't mean that they're hooven monsters trying to take over the world, but it tells you that they're all in the same bucket. They're all the same group of people that strive to use government for their own benefit. Okay, so Reagan is shot. 2 months into his presidency, he's shot. While he's still in the hospital recovering, they need to put on the image that he's doing great, right? So while he's still in the hospital recovering, he signs his first bill after being shot, which drastically expands federal power and spending in the dairy industry. While he's still recovering, Reagan then reauthorizes the funding for the B-1 and enacts the new drug enforcement bill, expanding the war on drugs. So in doing these couple of things here, he made GE happy, he made the Pentagon happy, and he made the CIA happy, because all these things, I can't really go into all the details of the dairy funding and how much, oddly enough, how much it helped the CIA. But the war on drugs reauthorization, or the war on drugs expansion, dramatically helped the CIA, because what do? The CIA deals drugs. Of course they do. They have been for a long time the major movers and shakers in the heroin industry. Okay, so after Reagan is shot, he makes no more serious cuts in government of any kind. He increases taxes 11 times, and he pushes through huge farm subsidies. All this happens after he's shot. Before he's shot, he's shrinking government, he's cutting taxes, he's not bowing to the GE political interest for the B-1. Soon as he's shot, everything turns around. And this stinker of a plane, this B-1, even in GE, we used to kind of jokingly refer to it as the program that never ends, because it was an endless supply of money to GE. And a lot of us in GE knew this. But, you know, what do you do? Anyway, hopefully that explains my little statement yesterday about why Ronald Reagan was shot. Now, you can put together the pieces however you want, but let's just say it's all coincidence. Let's do that. Let's just all be happy and just say it's all coincidence. After all, it was a crazed gunman, right? You can't control the crazed gunman with anything like drugs or hypnotism or anything like that, right? Well, anyway, so yesterday I also mentioned that Ron Paul said that he has about 2 million voting supporters, and I believe him. He feels he has about 2 million voting supporters right now in 2012. But when he got to the convention, that meant absolutely nothing. I said yesterday that the GOP cheated in every important state primary, and they openly cheated on the convention floor. And it's all been well documented, a lot of different sources on that. It's not hard to find that. Yesterday, I proposed the notion that their cheating saved Ron Paul's life. Had Ron Paul been too popular for the GOP to get away with cheating against him, they would have simply killed him, because Ron Paul would have never cut deals with those that are in power. Had he been too popular to cheat against, there would have been a lone gunman that would have appeared out of nowhere. We would have seen this. Now, I said this yesterday, we've already been prepared for just such an event. The public had already been set up to believe that the crazed lone gunman, this crazed lone gunman myth. And I said yesterday that you should think about the events of the last few months. Those people that control both parties had two backup plans for the convention if things went bad at the Republican convention, if it got out of control. One part of that plan involved that massive police presence at the convention. And the other part of that plan was, I believe, the lone gunman. And as I said yesterday, there's no way those who control the government and profit from it will ever sit back and allow a Ron Paul, any Ron Paul, or any true liberty candidate of any kind to ever really get control and destroy this racket that they're running out of Washington, D.C. Think about it for yourself. Would the Gambino family sit back and let their entire empire vanish just because of one guy? Why would the CIA let that happen? Why would the military-industrial complex let that happen? Why would the big farming interests allow that to take place? Think about how much money is at stake in the CIA's empire in the poppy fields of Afghanistan alone that American soldiers are guarding right now and NATO soldiers are guarding right now. Just think about the amount of money that it would mean for the CIA if a Ron Paul-type candidate was to get in, actually become president, and pull the U.S. forces out of Afghanistan. Think about what that would do to the CIA. And if you're not sure what I'm talking about with the CIA's connection with poppies, again, you know, and the heroin harvests, heroin trade, I should say, that's not a hard one to look up. Just do some Googling on that. Remember, D.C. was more than happy with the Taliban until the Taliban killed the poppy harvest in the year 2000. And that when they wiped out the 2000 growing season, it devastated the 2001 heroin market. And that devastated the CIA's underground funding. And in 2001, there had to be a reason to invade Afghanistan and get the poppy market back. Go to Wikipedia. Let's use Wikipedia. You know what? I'll put a link on today's podcast notes about the poppy harvest in Afghanistan. And just take a look over there. There's a chart in Wikipedia that's on that page that shows the poppy production from Afghanistan, and it shows the year that the Taliban cut the poppy production, and then it shows what happens as soon as the U.S. is in there in control and what happens to the poppy harvest under the CIA control. It'll amaze you if you've never actually seen it. Okay, now, so Ron Paul was by far the absolute best shot at liberty on a national scale that the U.S. has ever had. Going all the way back to the so-called founding fathers, Ron Paul has a clearer, more consistent concepts of liberty than anybody has ever had on a national scale, has ever had a chance to get elected to the presidency. And he never had a chance. Ron Paul never had a moment of a chance. Not only because they cheat, not only because they own the elections, not only because they have all the funding, you know, all the big funding in their pockets, but they just kill him. So liberty, the concepts of liberty, Ron Paul was admittedly their the best chance of getting a liberty candidate in, never had a chance. Not even a single chance. But think about this. Let's go to the moral aspect of this. Liberty. Can liberty be voted into existence? Can you have 10 people in a room and 6 of them want liberty and 4 of them want tyranny? Can you force those 4 that want tyranny to have liberty? Can you do that? Is that possible? Does that make any logical sense at all? Democracy is the act of forcing the will of the majority onto the minority. It's impossible to force liberty on anyone. So democracy on any scale, if we're talking about government, because all government is based on aggression. So all the governments that we know of today, I mean, you could theoretically produce a government that's purely voluntary, but that doesn't exist today. So all the governments that exist today exist through forced coercion, through aggression. So can you use the democratic process to force liberty on someone? You see, the whole concept is almost laughable. So then let's go back to the other question from yesterday. Is voting in a local election a practical way to produce liberty? Well, I said yesterday you can make dramatic changes on a local level with a relatively small amount of effort to control a local election and get in and get your will done in local government. You can do this. It doesn't take much money. It doesn't take much effort. You just organize small grassroots groups, and you get control of a mayorship, or you get control of a county commissioner or something like this. It happens all the time. Libertarians do it pretty regularly. But can you produce liberty by doing that? Can you use the democratic process and force liberty upon people who are enjoying their enslavement? Can you do that? I gave some examples yesterday about local situations where you can dramatically change local politics. But is that change a long-term net gain? Or are you just pumping water out from one chamber to another in a sinking ship? In order to really get at the heart of this, you have to face those three questions I was talking about yesterday. The three moral questions. Can government act without aggression? Is the use of government moral? And is it possible to get a net good by doing evil? I'm going to, again, read the zero aggression principle for you. The zero aggression principle is a moral stance which asserts that aggression is inherently illegitimate. Aggression, for the purpose of the zero aggression principle, is defined as the initiation or threatening of violence against a person or legitimately owned property of a person, specifically any unsolicited actions of others that physically affect the individual's property or person, no matter if the results of those actions is damaging, beneficial, or neutral to the owner, are considered aggressive when they are against the owner's free will. Now, the zero aggression principle is the only logic-based measurement of good or evil in the human experience. We can arbitrarily make rules. We can say, oh, here's the Ten Commandments, or here's this, or here's that. But when you really boil it down on a logical level, the zero aggression principle, or a variation of it, the non-aggression principle, or the golden rule, one way or the other, the zero aggression principle, or a variation of it, is the only logical way to measure what is good and what is evil. So then, if we examine that first question, and we say, can government act without aggression? And we start thinking about how a government acts, what a government can actually do and what it cannot do, exactly how does government on any level, we're talking about a town, we're talking about a dog catcher, we're talking about a president, we're talking about a Congress, government on any level, how does it function, how does it accomplish the things that it does? And when we boil it down, every single act of government is an act of aggression on someone, because government is a forced association entirely funded by theft. All of its power is maintained through violence and the threats of violence. So any act of government is by its very definition an act of aggression. So then everything, like even down to the point of the electricity that lights government buildings, is paid for with stolen money. The papers that they write on or that they print out and hand to someone, a ticket that a cop would hand to you, not only is it the aggression in the sense that he's using coercive means to collect taxation from people against their will, not only is that theft, but the actual piece of paper that he hands to you was purchased with stolen money and printed on with ink paid for by stolen money. So literally, everything in the process of government, every single thing, every act, every tiny little expenditure, every building that it owns, every uniform that it puts on a cop or on a soldier, or every aspect of government is based on aggression. There can be no act of government without aggression. Okay, now stick with me again. Another break. I'll be right back, and we'll jump right into this, and I'll finish off my argument on why voting on all level is not only immoral, but it's ultimately unproductive. Stick with me. I'll be right back. Folks, I want to talk to you about survival gear bags. Survival gear bags is about more than just great gear bags and survival kits. Check out their website by clicking the banner at badquaker.com. Survival Gear Bags has everything from Wise food storage products to tactical equipment to camping supplies to clothing and rain gear to hydration and purification systems to books and DVDs. Plus, Survival Gear Bags is known for its service, and it's owned and operated by people who understand and adhere to the zero aggression principle. So get over to Survival Gear Bags and get the stuff you need. Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards. Hi, this is Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker from BadQuaker.com. I listen to the Freedom Fiends live Sunday night on the Liberty Radio Network. That's LRN.FM. And you can hear the Freedom Fiends 24/7 on their streaming feed at freedomfiends.com. That's FreedomFiends.com. Okay, and thanks for sticking with me. Now, let's jump right back into this. Number two on our list, is the use of government moral? Okay, the question one determined if government can act without aggression. Well, if every act of the government, of any government, is an act of aggression, then the use of government to obtain any goal is immoral. Do you actually believe that forced association, called government, can, by use of its authority based on violence and threats of violence, do good? If you believe that, you have to realize that you're abandoning the zero aggression principle, and you're justifying your morality based on the results you want. Think about a different situation where you're justifying your behavior by what you ultimately want. What if you just want money? What if you want money and you're willing to set your morals aside, set the zero aggression principle aside so that you can get money? Doesn't matter what you want to use the money for. Let's say you want to use the money to do wonderful good things. You want to help the poor. You want to save children. You want to spare puppies from horrible deaths or something. Doesn't matter what you want to do with the money. You say, okay, I want to get money so I can do good with it. So how am I going to obtain all this money? Well, there's a liquor store down the street. You could just go knock off a liquor store, get that money, and go help those puppies, right? You see, of course not. Of course that's immoral. It's immoral to use aggression to do something, even if your ultimate goal is to do good. It's still immoral. Now, yesterday I mentioned the side note for question two was the Rothbard-Spooner argument that Rothbard makes in The Ethics of Liberty. He basically says that it's okay to vote because you're not authorizing the aggression of government when you vote. You're not all you're doing when you interact with government because it's a forced relationship. You are it's not necessarily immoral because you're being forced in this relationship. So let's say let's put it this way. Let's say you're being robbed, and there's an aggressor in front of you, and he's trying to rob you. And he gives you the choice. Well, hey, how about this? I can take your wallet or I can take your watch. Let's say he's a nice robber. He's still a robber. He's still a thief, but he's giving you a choice. Hey, I can take your wallet or I can take your watch. Which is it going to be? And you say, my father gave me this watch. My wallet only has like $50 in it. Here's my wallet. Thank you for letting me keep my watch. Okay, so you haven't done anything immoral in this situation by cooperating with the robber and by choosing the watch over the wallet. You haven't acted immorally. This is very much like the argument of driving on roads or using any other government service. We're forced at the point of a gun to accept this government. So if we get, if we're told, well, you're not allowed to build your own roads, the government will stop you from doing that. You're not allowed to have your own private security forces, without the government's authorization. The government will stop you from that. So you're stuck using the services of the government, and there's nothing immoral about that. But that's not voting. Voting is actively getting involved in the democratic process and attempting to make a change. My wife was talking to me. She was talking to somebody the other day, and they about the about voting, and they said, "Well, the way my wife or she was talking to a lady, and she says the way my husband and I take care of this is we sit down and we go through all the questions on the ballot, and all the different people, and we choose opposite sides on each one, so we both go vote. One votes on one side, one votes on the other side, so we neutralize each other and cancel each other out." And my wife was just like, "Are you even thinking through what you're saying?" Well, in a situation like that, maybe you're intentionally not use. Maybe that's not immoral. If you're guaranteeing that you're neutralizing your vote, maybe that's not immoral. It's crazy, but it's not immoral. But when you vote with the intention of bending government to your will, when you vote with the intended purpose of using government for your purposes, even if you think that purpose is to shrink government or make government less intrusive, it doesn't matter what your intentions are. When you're using the aggression of government, when you're involving yourself in the actual decision-making process of government, you are using government for your will. Now, let's just consider this for a little bit now. People talk about, let's address question number three. Can you produce something good by doing evil? People talk about defensive voting, or they talk about voting to shrink government, or they'll give the example if your master was going to beat you 10 times and you could vote and have him only beat you one time, shouldn't you vote for that? Well, there's a problem with this. When you vote, it's not a one-on-one relationship. It's not you with a master. It's not you with a robber. It's you directing the aggression of government onto people who have no relationship in any of this stuff whatsoever. No government action is singular. You're not dealing one-on-one with a master or one-on-one with a robber. It's more like, if you think of the defensive voting argument, and you say, I'm voting to defend myself against this aggressor, the government. The problem is, it's almost like if you've got a robber who's trying to rob you, and you're going to defend yourself against that robber by shooting him. The problem is, you only have a shotgun, and he's standing in a crowd of children, and you can't use government without affecting all those others involved. It's just like the shotgun. You can't shoot the robber with the shotgun without hitting other people around him. So it's immoral to fire your shotgun at the bad guy if he's standing among a group of innocent people. And that's the thing about using the weight of government, using the aggression of government. One of the basic things that Bastiat showed us is that it doesn't matter what your intentions are. Every act of government produces effects that are both seen and unseen. And you can't tell from the outside, you can't tell how these acts are going to work out through all the different ways that government affects different things. Any act of government is going to produce effects that are both seen and unseen. And like Bastiat shows, it doesn't matter how good it appears on the surface. The better it appears like it's going to do on the surface, the more hideous the long-term result is going to be. This is just how government works. So anytime you use government to obtain your goal, you are using the forces of coercion, aggression, the lies, the deceits of government. Think of Franz Oppenheimer. In his book, The State, Franz Oppenheimer says, let me read a little bit of it for you. "There are two fundamentally opposed means whereby man is impelled to obtain the necessary means for satisfying his desires. These are work and robbery, one's own labor and the forcible appropriation of the labor of others. I propose in the following discussion to call one's own labor and the equivalent exchange of one's own labor for the labor of others, the economic means for the satisfaction, the economic means for the satisfaction of needs, while the unrequited appropriation of the labor of others we will call the political means." So Oppenheimer says there's two ways you can accomplish stuff. You can use the ethical economic means, or you can use the unethical political means. All political means are theft. It doesn't matter if it's in a democratically elected government, if it's a king, or if it's a thief on the street. Anytime they're using aggression, coercion, theft, these things like this, this is how government functions. This is also how robbers function. It's how thieves function. It's how con men function. If you're using these things in any way, you're utilizing the political means. And the only other option is to not use the political means by using the economic means. In other words, your own sweat, your own labor. If you want something changed, go change it. Don't go and try to use the forces of government to inflict your changes upon other people. Let me see if I can get through the old lady argument. It's a little clunky, but it works if you think about it. The little old lady argument goes like this. Now, keep in mind that we don't currently have a perfect libertarian utopia where there's, you know, agencies that are all voluntarily based that take care of everything, like, you know, keeping the streets clean and keeping the streets maintained and keeping the police doing what they're supposed to be doing, providing security and not oppression. We don't have all this libertarian utopia around us. Currently, the government, the coercive government, is evil, yes, but it does provide certain services for people. It doesn't do it very well. It doesn't do it very efficiently. Sorry about the dog barking in the background. We're babysitting my son's dog still. The government doesn't do anything very efficiently. It does certainly doesn't act morally, but it does provide currently very necessary services for people. So we're going to take the old lady here. The old lady absolutely depends upon certain things to live, like her Social Security. She lives in a rough neighborhood. She's protected by police. I know they don't do that well of a job, but they do a job currently because there is no private security to replace them. So let's say if you vote to lower taxes in your town, or let's say you can vote to eliminate something evil like Social Security, you are using the force of government, the aggression of government, to take away something from her that she's worked her whole life expecting she'll have all the rest of her days. If you vote to cut the local police department, because the local police department are horribly corrupt. Let's just, in our scenario, we have a local police that are horribly corrupt. But among their corruption, they still provide a service to that little old lady. And we don't live in a perfect libertarian utopia. So if you cut the services of the police, as corrupt as they are, you cut those services for that little old lady, you have aggressed upon her because, at least in her eyes, she feels she's worked her whole life and paid taxes to have those services. And now you're taking them away from her. So in her eyes, you may not see the aggression. You may see that the police, the very existence of police is aggression. You may understand that. But right now, there's nothing to take its place. So when you make that act, you are aggressing upon the old lady. At least she believes you are. Now, I want to pull my conclusion up here. All government, as we know it today, is a forced association maintaining its power through coercive violence and the ongoing threat of violence. Democracies and so-called democratic republics, I could debunk that on its own. I could do a whole podcast on the silliness of the difference between a democracy and a so-called democratic republic, but I'm not going to. So democracies and so-called democratic republics allow some people to sway the behavior of government by way of their vote. The vote, by its very definition, is an attempt by the citizen to control the behavior of government. That's what the vote is. Is the vote real? Is it really something? If the vote can do something, and I've already shown that it can do something, on a local level, the vote is important and means something. If the vote can do something, if it has value, then by its very definition, voting is an attempt to use government to satisfy your desires at the cost of someone else's desire. Therefore, voting is aggression. Two wrongs can never make a right. Changing the math doesn't change the principle. You don't get evil, you don't get good by doing evil. It doesn't matter, you know, 2 wrongs, 10 wrongs, 10,000 wrongs. It doesn't matter the numbers. You cannot produce good by doing evil. You might, on a short term, appear to be doing good. Remember, if we rob the bank, we rob the liquor store, we get money, that's good. We take that money, we go and we give it to the poor, we save puppies. We do good with that money. It seems like we did good, right? But there's a deeper principle. In the long run, evil can only produce evil. First off, you don't see what you just did to those people who are depending on that money from the liquor store or from the bank. You don't see the damage you did by robbing them when you're out helping the puppies. But there's another evil, too, that takes place. When you do evil, you don't only harm the victim of your aggression. You harm yourself. When you do evil, when you aggress upon another person, you harm yourself. And if we've already shown that the act of voting is aggression, then even if you can't see who it hurts you. Because anytime you act aggressively, anytime you commit an act of aggression, it not only hurts the victim of that act of aggression, but it kills a little bit of you inside. It hurts you, even if you can't tell it. When I debate Mark in a couple days, I'm going to lay out an argument that I call the Jainist argument, and I'll talk about Jainism. It's an aspect of Hinduism that is extremely consistent, and I'll show in that argument that when a person commits a tiny little act of aggression, it doesn't matter how big or how small, above and beyond the harm it does to the victim, the aggressor is harmed as well, you see? Therefore, we must abandon the political means and turn our faith away from the state and away from aggression and away from democracy. It's only through one's own labor and voluntary exchange can a net good in society be produced. No amount of aggression, none, can ever produce good, only more evil. Now, I believe I've demonstrated here that voting is immoral, and in the long term, on both the local and the national level, voting will not produce a net good. It doesn't matter what the temporary actions produce. It doesn't matter what produces on the surface. You have to think beyond that, and you have to recognize what the long-term damage is with voting. And you have to realize what it does to you, to your own soul, deep inside you. What does it do to your mental, to your psyche? What does it do to your mental capacity when deep inside you know, and you do know, that voting is using the aggression of government to accomplish your will? Voting is aggression. Folks, thank you very much for listening, and for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you.